You are listening to Latin Waves, a weekly syndicated program. For more information about our program, visit www.latinwavesmedia.com.
We are privileged to be speaking with John Elmer. He is international journalist. We're reaching in Bethlehem. Thank you for joining us, John.
Thanks for having me.
We've been talking about the role of Canadian as a peacekeeping nation. I guess this is a myth that has been well ingrained in the minds of Canadians. But when we look at our role today, many people still refuse this image of Canadian as an occupying nation. Talking about Afghanistan, what has been our legacy in this country?
Well, I think when historians look back on it, they'll see that Canada was the front and center holding down the main aspect of the counter-revolutionary, counter-insurgency war in Kandahar province, the most important province in Afghanistan. Canada was involved immediately, first country to join the United States war, which was declared almost immediately after the attacks of September 11th, 2001. Canada had warships in Eastern Europe that immediately were dispatched. Canadian Special Forces were on the ground right away in October of 2001. And so despite the fact that it took Canadian troops themselves several months to deploy to Afghanistan, our Special Forces were on the ground immediately. And since 2005, we've been the most important player in the counterinsurgency war, to such a degree that the Americans often cite Canada as actually the model nation in terms of deploying all aspects of the foreign policy apparatus. And when we talk about the foreign policy apparatus, we mean, in Canada's terms, the development, the Canadian International Development Agency, the transformational diplomacy on the ground, the Department of Foreign Affairs and International Trade, and the Department of National Defense, all working a concerted effort to undermine the liberation forces in Afghanistan, whoever they may be. And there are multiple actors and multiple factors involved in the attempts to overthrow the occupation regime in Afghanistan. And that regime in power in Kabul, Canada will be seen as the main backer of that regime. Canadian military officers are embedded within the key portfolios of the Afghan ministries that we've seen with the WikiLeaks releases that are corrupt beyond belief, bought and paid for at every level. And this it didn't really take WikiLeaks to release this information. We've known this all along. Hamid Karzai won an election last year that was fraudulent in every aspect. In some provinces in the south, you had voter turnouts measured in the dozens. I mean, in other provinces in the south, you had candidates winning with 175% of the vote. And so Canada's legacy, well, it's still ongoing. I mean, we can't look back and say it's a legacy at this point. It's an active participation. The switch between removing our infantry soldiers on the ground in Afghanistan, the battle groups, and switching to a concerted training mission, it's categorically not a shift in the mission. It's always been a 3D mission, diplomacy, development, and defense working hand in hand. It's inextricable. And you can see that all throughout the documents. The American counterinsurgency plan has just as much to do with training and embedding within the military as it does fighting actively on the ground against the Taliban. And in many cases, it actually is more important to be doing that work because the war itself is being lost. The active combat aspect of the war is being lost. And so if Canada can switch to another aspect of the intervention, it's beneficial both for the Canadian forces, who have been saying for years that they need a break. It's really an operational pause more than it is any kind of political decision by Canada. Canada's army's small. We've been rotating through every aspect of the infantry of the Canadian Army, rotating them through Afghanistan now for 5 straight years. The troops are tired, the materiel, the tanks, the trucks, they need work, they need time to fix them up and to get them back up to speed, because Canada doesn't have the military depth to carry out this indefinite occupation. So in many cases, the switch to the training aspect will be, in many cases, more of the legacy in Afghanistan, as this corrupt government of Hamid Karzai needs to be propped up by countries like Canada.
In March 2008, you were reporting on the agreement by the Canadian government to extend the mission to 2011, and now again Harper has agreed to yet again extend this mission. At that time, you were speaking about a NATO and U.S. Report, how NATO and U.S. airstrikes during the period of 2007 had dropped more than 2,926 bombs. That was an increase from 1,770 in 2006. You noted how more than 8,000 people were killed in 2007. How has this been impacted with the use of military drones in the region and this new, we are told now, more concise targeting of militants?
Well, I mean, the main reason why that's happening, the death from the air, is a testament to the resistance on the ground. The forces can't move on the ground. And so a key aspect of Canada's extending the mission back a few years ago was to increase the number of attack helicopters, increase the number of shuttle helicopters for moving supplies and troops, because the roads can't be driven on. None of the roads can be driven on. And that's what we see, that the vast majority of Canadian deaths in Afghanistan have been from roadside bombs and not from active combat. And so it's necessary to move to the air. And there's no precision. I mean, the level of intelligence that Canadians and Americans have on the ground in Afghanistan, if it weren't a life and death situation, it would be laughable. They're getting the lowest level intelligence, and they're carrying out these operations with very little idea of who they're targeting. And just an idea of how pathetic Canadian intelligence is on the ground in Afghanistan, a year and a half ago, Sarpoza Prison, the largest prison in southern Afghanistan, home to the both rank and file and field commanders of the insurgency that had been captured, that prison was liberated, and Canadians didn't even know about it until an hour and a half after the prison had been liberated. This is one of the largest prison breaks, bar none, in world history. And it was of not of thugs and crooks, it was of the insurgents. And it was field-level commanders, operational commanders, who were freed. Intelligence so poor that the night before, the prison guards talk about how in the night before they were sent a message that said that they should leave the prison at X hour. So, you know, you get this idea, and these are the level of intelligence of Canadian attacks. So, you know, somebody sending a message that says there's a meeting happening in this building, and Canadians are sending American or British Harrier jets over and bombing. And that's how you get these death tolls that we're seeing consistently and worsening. And actually, the Americans are suggesting at this point right now that the level of combat, the increase in the level of combat, the increase in the Afghan death toll, both civilian and fighters, is actually an indication of success, because it means that the Americans and Canadians are moving into territory that previously they weren't going into. And so they're poking the hornet's nest, if you will, going into territory that the Taliban holds, which, if you look at a map of southern Afghanistan, is virtually the entire southern Afghanistan is held by the Taliban. They run a parallel government in almost every village and town. The forward operating bases that were the core of the counterinsurgency project have been overrun, and the forces have been driven back behind the wire, is the term, onto this massive air base at Kandahar Airfield, where the journalists sit in a media tent with computers, and the forces stay behind the wire because if they go out, they're attacked and killed. And when they die, when Canadian troops die in Afghanistan, that's when the mission becomes untenable for the Canadian public at large. It doesn't really have any bearing on the number that we kill. It's how many of our boys that are killed. And that has dictated popularity or lack thereof of the war in Afghanistan. So previous to 2005, before Canadians were in Kandahar province on the ground, the Canadian death toll was literally just a handful, and most of those were killed in one incident of friendly fire by American forces. Well, once Canadians took up the heart of the counterinsurgency operation in Kandahar province, and began moving on the ground, began moving around in the in Taliban territory, they started dying. And they started dying at rates of 20, 30, 40 a summer. And it was then that the war began to tilt. And now by 2010, in order to keep popularity of the war in Afghanistan, we have to limit the number of Canadian troops that die, hence the aerial drone strikes, the helicopter gunship attacks, and moving our forces with helicopters. Because most critically, in order for the war to carry on in Afghanistan, and indeed elsewhere for Canada's foreign policy disposition, it's not the natives on the ground that matter. It's Canadian public opinion that matters. Canadians listening to the radio right now have more control over Canadian policy than Taliban fighters do in southern Afghanistan, because if Canadians were to refuse the mission, refuse the government that backs the mission, force a real anti-war government to come into power in Canada, the Canadian foreign policy disposition, which goes beyond Afghanistan, we have Canadian forces on the ground here in Bethlehem, for example, training an anti-government force, an unelected government backed by Canadian forces, which is basically the same paradigm we have in Afghanistan. It's the same paradigm that we saw in Haiti, where we have fraudulent elections that were backed by the Canadians, endorsed by the Canadians, brought into being in the first place because of a Canadian, French, and American coup and occupation of Haiti. So we look at each of these individual cases. We tend to, in our media, look at them as individual one-offs. But if you put them together and take a look at the foreign policy apparatus working as a concerted whole, you see that what's happening in Afghanistan is happening in many countries around the world, and the entire Canadian forces is being trained, readied, prepared, both intellectually and physically, with materiel, with doctrine, with training, and with the forces themselves to fight these wars going forward. So if Afghanistan loses its popularity in Canada because of Canadian soldiers' death toll, it creates what Canadian planners call the Afghan paradox. On one hand, Afghanistan, because it was popular, it was backed by the body politic by and large after September 11th, it gave Canada this opportunity to have what Robert Gates, the American Defense Secretary, calls a laboratory in Afghanistan, a laboratory for transformation of the militaries of the Western world towards this counterinsurgency disposition, towards this 3D defense, diplomacy, development, all acting in unison disposition. But the paradox is that if Afghanistan becomes something like a Vietnam and creates this sort of immediate idea in the Canadian body politic that to have our soldiers abroad must be like Afghanistan rather than, as you said in your lead, peacekeepers doing good, then the foreign policy project becomes untenable. And that's the Afghan paradox, and that's the potency that Canadians have. Canadians who are listening to this interview, Canadians who cast ballots and organize within civil society, the power that Canadians have is to change the course of Canadian foreign policy, because Afghanistan, as the Canadian defense planners say, is a model. It's not the model. It may be that in Somalia we use just the training aspect. That's what's happening in Palestine. We don't actually have Canadians firing guns in Palestine, but we have them doing the core training work of the force that is firing the guns, that is arresting the teachers and the doctors and the journalists, that's arresting people for how they voted, that's firing people, you know, for who they voted for in an election, and imprisoning large swaths of the civil society apparatus that, in Palestine, in this example, created probably the most vibrant civil society in the entire Arab world. That's what Canada's doing, and the power that Canadians have to overturn that can be seen through the Canadian need to justify the war and to have Canadians support the war in Afghanistan, whether that's through promotions like Canadian soldiers rappelling down from the rafters at a Vancouver Canucks hockey game, or throwing out the first pitch at a Blue Jays game, or at the Grey Cup on the sidelines, whatever it is to create popularity for Canadian forces. This is a key attribute, because if the Canadian body politic doesn't support this war, we have the actual possibility to overturn Canada's role in the world.
But you mentioned one very important point, that many of the people that are being imprisoned, that are being in Palestine, for instance, are teachers, are the parts of civil society, precisely the elements we need to have a society that isn't engaging, that is looking beyond military alternatives, but rather to find solutions through dialogue. Who are the people who are most impacted by this war?
In any war, the people that are most impacted are the people that are trying to carry out their basic daily lives. And in Afghanistan, that situation, you know, as we heard the American planners saying that we were going to bomb Afghanistan back to the Stone Age, people think of Afghanistan and Canada as this sort of, tribal throwback society that's 100 years behind the times. But as recently as the 1970s, Afghanistan was one of the most progressive countries in the world, in the developing world, and had a government that was educating, you know, doing all of the things that the Canadians are purporting to be doing today, but are not doing, like building schools and educating and having basic health care and basic necessities for the people at large. So today, we have a situation in Afghanistan where it's, thrown back to the Stone Age based on the fact that it's too dangerous to move anywhere. It's too dangerous to drive on the roads, so you can't export your crops. You can't have a proper functioning economy, proper import economy. You have 185,000 foreign occupation troops, plus all the development workers, plus all this private security forces that are soaking up the vast, vast, overwhelming majority of the resources that should be going to the population itself. Canada, the U.S., should be pulling out of Afghanistan, and they should be paying reparations for the crimes committed over the last decade. In fact, over the last 25 years, when Canada, the U.S., and the Western powers supported the Mujahideen in a brutal war against the Northern Alliance for a decade, a war that killed tens of thousands of people and destroyed the civil infrastructure of the country. Those reparations should be paid as cash money that gets diffused into the body politic. So forget giving aid money to, free the children, save the children, NGOs that have been created by military people that understand what the situation on the ground is. Many ex-Canadian forces, colonels that retire, are going and starting NGOs in Afghanistan because they understand that billions of dollars in aid money is being dumped on this country, and the stipulation is that it goes, as all aid money does, the stipulation is that it goes first and foremost to Canadian interests. That is that if CEDA is funding a project, they want to fund it through a Canadian NGO so that money, two-thirds of CEDA dollars or more, end up back in a Canadian pocket, not in the pocket of the people that are impacted the most on the ground, the school children, the mothers that are trying to raise their families, the laborers who are trying to go out and just make a decent living to support their families. That's who the war impacts most significantly, because the elite aspect of society generally tends to benefit from the war, as you've seen in Afghanistan with the warlords getting rich and the NGOs and the sort of five-star globalization NGOs living in Kabul behind massive blast walls in opulent mansions, completely separate from the rest of the society.
In Latin America, the term the war on terror has been a blanket term to oppress and militarize the streets to counteract those voices who oppose privatization of public sector, water, electricity. The silence is the voices of people who oppose the impunity with which some governments conduct trade and operations that basically give away the resources of the country to either U.S. or European interests. How has this term, the war on terrorism, create a narrative that prolongs and prevents any kind of resolution, any kind of end to this conflict?
Foreign policy interests in Central Asia are significant. The direction of the pipelines that run out of the Caspian Basin, how they run Afghanistan borders, the key strategic countries in the region, Iran, China, it's in the main area of the new undeveloped oil and gas reserves in the western frontiers of what was the Soviet Empire. And the way the Soviet Empire operated was to develop from the inside out. And so there, by the time the empire fell in the 80s, the outer reaches, the frontier reaches of what are the Caspian Basin and the stands, if you will, today, are undeveloped, largely untapped. And in a world with you know, where oil and gas is both liquid gold and the main lever of world power, where those pipelines run is not insignificant. It's not the reason for the war, but it's not an insignificant aspect of what's going on. To have 200,000 NATO and American forces in Afghanistan, special forces, both training, learning the trade, perfecting their skills, but also being based in permanent bases in that region, is not insignificant. And that is something that goes beyond simply, you know, trying to have one government or another in power before we, quote-unquote, leave the country or have an exit strategy. The embassies and the military bases that are being built in Iraq and Afghanistan are permanent. They're the biggest embassies on Earth, and they're the biggest military bases on Earth. Kandahar airstrip, airfield, is the busiest, literally the busiest airstrip on the face of the Earth. You know, to have a position, a geostrategic position in that region is not insignificant. And to have companies right there to immediately grab up key contracts in that region, to have it as a launch pad for, quote, stabilizing, which means keeping under the American hegemony, American-Canadian hegemony. Because we have to remember that Canadian oil and gas and Canadian mining companies are as good as any in the world. Canadian mining and development of the type that's happening in Central Asia and the Caspian region is right in Canada's economic wheelhouse. So it's not Canada doing the bidding or being the lapdog of the American project. It's Canadians with their own individual corporate, economic, and foreign policy interests within Afghanistan that allow the war to continue. These withdrawals, for example, Canada moving its battle group out of Afghanistan by the end of this year, is actually a strategic benefit. It's a net gain for Canada because we keep the same influence on the ground. We keep the same bases and the same foothold in the region, but we bring home the sort of, you know, the boys from Winnipeg, or the boys from Burnaby, who are, when they die, become, you know, become fodder for Canadians not wanting to be a part of the mission. What Canadian oil and gas companies, what Canadian special forces and spooks do on the ground doesn't really impact Canadian body politic all that much. But when our boys, you know, our teenagers start dying in Afghanistan for a war that they don't even know why they're fighting, it creates a narrative that Canadians have a tougher time supporting. Many, over the course of the last decade of Canadian forces in Afghanistan, the number of troops that have rotated through Afghanistan creates a situation that in Canada, many of us know somebody, or our families know somebody who's a soldier. And it's not as easy to look at that soldier, that teenager, or in many cases Canadian soldiers are actually older. They're the oldest army in the world, actually. But when we know one of those individuals, we Canadians maybe have a harder time looking and saying, oh, that's an imperial project for the benefit of oil and gas reserves and Canadian foreign policy. And so it creates a certain familiarity that the spooks and special ops don't. And that's the vulnerability of Canadians having those battle groups on the ground in terms of the interests of the Stephen Harpers and Michael Ignatius. Is that we care a little bit more about these boys than we might about some you know, unknown bearded special forces soldier that we never hear his name or get introduced to. So really, we have to understand that going forward, the impact that Canadians have on Canadian foreign policy is bigger than the natives have on Canada's fighting, although the natives have a significant role to play, as the Taliban and the Afghan resistance has shown. It's possible that the Afghan resistance attacks on Canadian forces will make Canadian foreign policy going forward a lot more difficult to pull off, And if the Canadian body politic gets behind those national liberation movements and understands that Canada is not a force for good, is not a peacekeeping nation, and in fact is an aggressive expeditionary force on par, if not in size, then in meaning with the Americans.
Thank you so much for being with us. Why should people take the time to actively work to end our role as war mongers rather than peacekeepers in the world?
Well, I mean, beyond the elementary fact that we're killing people and we're destroying people's livelihoods, I think one of the most interesting aspects of the Canadian milieu is that we have more privilege, more space, more time to pursue these interests than almost any other country in the world, arguably more than any country in the world. And in fact, Canadians could have a significant, dramatic impact on policy by contributing almost no personal time to it. I'm not one that advocates ballot box, but if you just look at something as elementary as that, the Liberals and the Conservatives have been able to carry out a foreign policy consensus that, because the NDP doesn't provide any meaningful opposition, in fact, the NDP has four times allowed the mission to continue by not voting or voting in favor of the war, that there's no force for the NDP to try to respond to public opinion. If people just made it known that they were not going to vote for the government that was reinforcing this war, that could have a dramatic impact, let alone getting involved in civil society aspects within society, which I would argue is a necessity. It's a responsibility that Canadians have, both because our forces are fighting abroad and destroying livelihoods abroad, but also because we have more space, more privilege, and more ability to do that than almost any other country in the world. And with that privilege comes a responsibility. And I think that if Canadians did see the things that I see reporting from the Middle East and the kind of carnage and human destruction that I've seen, I do think that they would change their minds. That being said, we've seen significant destruction and carnage, and I think people do understand what happens when they see pictures from Iraq or Afghanistan or Palestine. So I think something else has to be taking place beyond this sort of shock value. But I think it's very elementary. People just need to think about it and think about the impact that we're having on other people's lives and act to redress that.
Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Take care.
Cambia lo superficial, cambia también lo profundo.
We have come to the end of our show, Latin Waves. Latin Waves is a weekly syndicated program produced and broadcast from the studios of CGSF Radio in Burnaby, BC. The program is available free of charge to campus and community stations across Canada and the U.S. For more information about our work or to support our efforts, please visit our website at www.latinwavesmedia.com. Bye for now.